The reading of God's Word from the 21st chapter of Matthew's Gospel, beginning with verse 33. Jesus is speaking. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, he dug a wine press in it, and he built a watchtower. And then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. When the harvest time approached, the landowner sent his servants to the tenants to collect his fruit. The tenants seized his servants. They beat one. They killed another. They stoned a third. The landowner then sent other servants to them more than the first time, and the tenants treated them the same way. Last of all, he sent his son to them. They will respect my son, he said. They will respect my son. But when the tenants saw the son, they said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and take his inheritance." So they took the son and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? And the religious leaders replied, "He will bring those wretches to a wretched end. And he will rent the vineyard to other tenants, and they will give him his share of the crop at harvest time." So Jesus said to them, "Have you never read in the scriptures, 'The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes.' Therefore, I tell you that the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will produce its fruit. And he who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed." And when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard the parables of Jesus, they knew he was talking about them, and they looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that Jesus was a prophet. May God add his blessings to this, the reading of his word. As most of you know, and as the old saying puts it, habits are so very hard to break. And they are they not? Most of the time we associate that saying with bad habits, biting your fingernails, squeezing the toothpaste from the middle of the tube, constantly checking your smartphone during the sermon. That's a very bad habit, hard to break. And even now, as I offer those examples in your mind, you know, you are thinking of bad habits that you have really wrestled to do away with because of these voices of influence in your mind that, you know, are telling you that's a bad thing. You need to stop it. You need to stop it. But for the life of you, you can't seem to stop it, no matter how hard you try. But there are good habits as well. Habits that stay with us in large measure because of those influencers in our lives who instilled those good practices in us. I don't care if I live to be 100 years of age. If there is a person who is one day older than I am, I am going to respond to those people with yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am, because that's how I was brought up, as were many of you. That is, I believe, a good habit that we instill in our children. I tried really hard to do that with my children. Some years ago, there was an explosion in West Alabama. You may have heard it here in Birmingham. Our daughter had gone to visit my parents. My daughter is a strong-willed woman now. She's always been that way. She was born that way. I don't know how Larkin will be, but she may not be silent all of her days. Our daughter, so strong-willed. Her grandmother, my mother, same way. Mother called me one day and she said, "You'll never guess what Corey, our daughter, did." I said, "Well, what did she do?" She said, "Well, we got into a bit of an argument. Our daughter was 5 years old at the time. And do you know what your daughter said to me? We got angry and she didn't want to do something that I wanted her to do. And she looked at me and she said, 'That's no without a ma'am.'" Probably heard it here in Birmingham, the explosion. "No, without a ma'am," our daughter said. Now, I know that there are parents today who just don't hold their children up to those standards and that particular habit. You see it as a charming throwback to a past day, but it really isn't something that people should expect from children today. And I really don't quibble with that. So this isn't a sermon about teaching your children or your grandchildren to say yes, sir, and no, sir, and yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Though I do believe that the one consideration that we should hold one another up to, not just our children, but all of us, is the consideration of respect, That showing respect for one another in word and deed is a very important value. It doesn't matter if you grew up in the country or the city, if you grew up in the South or the North, if you grew up an American or a citizen of another country. It seems to be a cultural value that has sustained itself over the millennia, so that whenever one individual treats another with any measure of disrespect, there are explosions, or worse, there are consequences that someone must be expected to pay. And when you look at this parable that is before us this morning, the parable of the evil tenants, essentially it is a parable about massive, massive disrespect. Now, when we look at this parable, there are two considerations that I have to point out before we get into it. The first is the larger context of the parable. This is actually the third of a series of responses that Jesus is making to the chief priest and the Pharisees, who have been disrespecting Jesus by questioning his spiritual authority. So they want to know, where do you get your authority in all that you're doing? And Jesus says, "Well, let me ask you a question. Where did John the Baptist get his authority?" And they're reluctant to answer Jesus' question. They're afraid because of the high esteem in which the crowds held John the Baptist. And so they dodge the question. Then Jesus secondly tells them a parable of two sons. And there's one son that doesn't respect his father, because he disobeys his father at every turn. There is another son, a second son, who does everything that his father asks. Everything. So Jesus says, "Who do you think is the obedient son?" And That parable makes them uncomfortable because they see where Jesus is going. And finally, he tells them this parable. And after Jesus tells the chief priests and the Pharisees the parable of the evil tenants, what does Matthew say? They are ready to silence him. They're ready to put him to death. Ultimate act of disrespect. That's the first consideration, the context. It has to do with responses that Jesus offers to those religious leaders who are questioning his authority. Second consideration is that this is not the first time that anyone told a story about the possibilities of a lush vineyard. In fact, Jesus, no doubt, took as the backdrop of his story a previous parable that we read about in the fifth chapter of Isaiah's prophecy. So in the fifth chapter, Isaiah tells the story of a vineyard that God creates, and Israel is the vineyard, and God's expectation is that the vineyard produces fruit, that God's people work for justice and righteousness among those who are disrespected in their day. And that's what God expects. God expects his people to treat other people with mercy and with compassion. And Isaiah says, now if that doesn't happen, what God will do is he will allow the vineyard to become a place of devastation, and others will overrun it. And that's precisely what happened with first the Assyrian invasion and then the Babylonian invasion. So Jesus draws upon that parable in order to confront the religious leaders of his day with their disrespect toward him and their inability to live up to God's expectations of showing righteousness and justice and mercy and compassion to everyone. So he tells a story. Landowner plants a vineyard, and he does everything that's necessary for the vineyard to grow choice grapes. I mean, he builds a wall around it, a hedge of protection. He puts a wine press in it. And unlike the vineyard in Isaiah's story, this one that Jesus tells does really well. It produces fruit. There's something to be offered during the harvest season to the landowner. So he hires these tenants to work the vineyard, and they work it. And they work it well, and it produces a crop. And when harvest time comes, what does the landowner do? He sends servants to receive his fruit, Jesus says. And these tenants, can you imagine? They take those servants and they beat them and they kill them. And so the landowner sends even more servants to the tenants, and they do the same to those servants. And finally, the landowner sends his own son. And he's thinking to himself, this is my son whom they will respect. They'll respect my son. But they do not respect the landowner's son. They say to themselves, hey, here is the heir. If we kill him, the vineyard will be ours. And that's exactly what they do. And when
Jesus tells that story to the religious leaders, you'll notice they don't have any problem seeing that these really are dastardly tenants. So that when Jesus says, well, what do you think the landowner is going to do with those tenants? And they say as exuberantly as they know how, he will take those wretched tenants and he will bring them to a wretched end. And they do not understand that in the process of making that response, they have offered a subtle acknowledgement of their own guilt in terms of how they have disrespected Jesus, questioning his authority, questioning his ministry, questioning the validity of all that he has said and done. They do not realize how guilty they are of not acknowledging Jesus to be the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and they certainly do not see the guilt and the shame that they will heap upon themselves when they will see that Jesus is arrested and nailed to the cross. And that is why Jesus, in response to their answer, quotes this 118th Psalm and says, you know, God's doing something new in your midst and you can't see it. And you're stumbling on it and you're going to be crushed by it. But there will be some who will recognize it. This is the Lord's doing, they will say, and it is marvelous in our sight. He'll take the work from you, Jesus says, and he'll give it to someone else. Someone who will respect God's intent. Now, the tendency that we have is to look at this parable and say, oh, I know what Jesus was trying to say. He's trying to say the landowner is God. And the servants, they are the prophets whom God has sent to his people. And of course, the vineyard is ancient Israel, and the tenants are the religious leaders of the day. And the Son is Jesus. God sent Jesus into the world, and the religious leaders put him to death. So God's going to take away the work of the vineyard from the Jewish people, and he's going to give it to us, followers of Jesus. And that's the story. But you see what that does. That's too easy. And Jesus never told a parable that was heard that easily and at that safe of a distance. There's something more. So what might it look like if this morning we heard the parable from the perspective of the chief priest and the Pharisee? If we heard the parable from the perspective of those to whom the work was given, but for one reason or another came to a place in our faith journey where we began to have a sense of ownership and entitlement, you know, this is my work, it's not really God's work. Oh, I can say that it's God's work, but deep down in my heart, I want the work to bring fulfillment to me. So that you know how that plays out. We get called to a place of service, but after a while, we may say to ourselves, you know, singing in the choir just doesn't bring me any more fulfillment. You know, when I started out, it was wonderful. But I decided that it just wasn't happening for me, and so I'm going to leave. Because it wasn't meeting my needs, as if any act of service is supposed to meet my need and bring me fulfillment instead of glorifying God. or I'm a deacon. You know, I was ordained a deacon and they set me apart. But you know, it's just that it takes too much time. And I only have so much time in the day. And so I don't know that I can really give of myself to that type of service anymore, because it's just getting in the way of everything that I think I need to be doing, as if time is my time and it's not God's time. Or any act of service. I'm not picking on the choir, the deacons, because we don't have a problem with any of these groups. That's why I use them as examples. But your place of service, place to which God has called you, you know, it's not bringing me fulfillment. I don't have the time that I had anymore. It's getting in the way of business or whatever. How often is it the case that we are guilty in the same way as the chief priest and the Pharisees of bringing massive disrespect to the cause of Christ because we are living under this delusion that it's our work, it's our service, it's my time, it's my business, when God is clearly saying, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. So what do we do about it? Marilyn McIntyre is professor of medical humanities at the University of California in San Francisco. She is a person of faith, and she writes on spiritual themes. And in one of her works, she talks about some practical ways in which followers of Jesus can escape the self-centered consumerism, as she calls it, that characterizes too much of American Christianity. It's all about me. No, it's not. No, it's not. And how we overcome that temptation to make it all about me. I think one suggestion that she offers, better than any of the rest, all good ones, but the best one, every day, she says, followers of Jesus ought to awaken, look at the opportunities the day brings, and ask themselves the question, what is it that I have to share today? What is it that I have to share today? Sharing my time, sharing my talents, sharing my possessions. What can I give in the form of service to extend the presence of Jesus and to bless another person? And I read that suggestion and I thought to myself, Matthew 25, the division of the sheep and goats, and Jesus saying to his disciples that when the Son of Man comes in his glory, to those who have been faithful, to those who have been obedient, to those who have committed themselves in sacrificial service, to those who have been good sons and daughters of God, Jesus will say to them, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. You know this story. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was without clothes, and you gave me clothes. I was sick, and you cared for me. I was in prison, and you came and visited me. And on that day, Jesus says, those sons and daughters of God will say to the Son of Man, when did we see you in that dire condition? And Jesus says, the Son of Man will respond, when you did it unto the least of these, my brothers and my sisters, you've done it also to me. You've done it also to me. So in a day when the temptation exists and the pressure is exerted, pressure that comes from all around us, to make it about us,
expanding our influence and reaching our potential and gaining some leverage over the competition, what might it look like if we glorified God and magnified the Son and treated others, especially the marginalized and the dispossessed in our day, treated them as people created in the image of God? Jesus would say, you're treating them with more than respect. You're treating them just like I treated them. You're treating them as if you were treating me. And for followers of Jesus, there's no higher praise than hearing the well done, you good and faithful servant. This is the fruit for which I have been looking.